There isn't a festival at which the king does not preside, surrounded by a radioactive aura shining forth all over his body and raising itself like a coronet above his head. Anyone touching him is severely burned. He can move from place to place through the air at crucial moments, supposedly by inspiration of divine spirit. He fills the temple with a pearly internal light at a gesture. There is no end to these quite simple tricks that we perform for his benefit, but even the priests believe them while working them personally.
Bad, said Cermak, biting his lip. I could cry, like the fountain in City Hall Park, said Bort earnestly, when I think of the chance we muffed.
Take the situation 30 years ago, when Hardin saved the Foundation from Anacreon. At that time, the Anacreonian people had no real conception of the fact that the Empire was running down. They had been more or less running their own affairs since the Zeonian Revolt, but even after communications broke down and Leopold's pirate of a grandfather made himself king, they never quite realized the Empire had gone kaput. If the Emperor had had the nerve to try, he could have taken over again with 2 cruisers, and with the help of the internal revolt that would have certainly sprung to life. And we could have done the same. But no, Hardin established monarch worship. Personally, I don't understand it. Why? 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 What, demanded J. Morsi suddenly, does Verisov do? There was a day when he was an advanced actionist. What's he doing there? Is he blind, too? I don't know, said Bort curtly. He's high priest to them. As far as I know, he does nothing but act as advisor to the priesthood on technical details. Figurehead, blast him, figurehead. There was silence all around, and all eyes turned to Cermak. The young party leader was biting a fingernail nervously, and then said loudly, No good, it's fishy. He looked around him and added more energetically, Is Hardin then such a fool?
Seems to be, shrugged Bort.
Never. There's something wrong. To cut our own throats so thoroughly and so hopelessly would require colossal stupidity. More than Hardin could possibly have, even if he were a fool, which I deny. On the one hand, to establish a religion that would wipe out all chance of internal troubles. On the other hand, to arm Anacreon with all weapons of warfare. I don't see it.
The matter is a little obscure, I admit, said Bort. But the facts are there. What else can we think?
Walto said jerkily, Outright treason. He's in their pay.
But Cermak shook his head impatiently.
I don't see that either. The whole affair is as insane and meaningless. Tell me, Bort, have you heard anything about a battle cruiser that the Foundation is supposed to have put into shape for use in the Anacreon Navy?
Battle cruiser?
An old Imperial cruiser.
No, I haven't, but that doesn't mean much. The Navy Yards are religious sanctuaries, completely inviolate on the part of the lay public. No one ever hears anything about the fleet.
Well, rumors have leaked out. Some of the party have brought the matter up in council. Hardin never denied it, you know. His spokesman denounced rumor mongers and let it go at that. It might have significance.
It's of a piece with the rest, said Bort. If true, it's absolutely crazy, but it wouldn't be worse than the rest.
I suppose, said Orsi, Hardin hasn't any secret weapon waiting. That might...
Yes, said Cermak viciously. A huge jack-in-the-box that will jump out at the psychological moment and scare old Venus into fits. The Foundation may as well blow itself out of existence and save itself the agony suspense if it has to depend on any secret weapon.
Well, said Orsi, changing the subject hurriedly, the question comes down to this. How much time have we left, eh, Bort?
All right, it's the question. But don't look at me, I don't know. The Anacreonian press never mentions the Foundation at all. Right now, it's full of the approaching celebrations and nothing else. Leopold is coming of age next week, you know.
We have months, then, Walto smiled for the first time that evening. That gives us time.
That gives us time, my foot, ground out Bort impatiently. The king's a god, I tell you. Do you suppose he has to carry on a campaign of propaganda to get his people into fighting spirit? Do you suppose he has to accuse us of aggression and pull out all stops on cheap emotionalism? When the time comes to strike, Leopold gives the order and the people fight, just like that. That's the damnedness of the system. You don't question a god. He may give the order tomorrow, for all I know, and you can wrap tobacco around that and smoke it.
Everyone tried to talk at once, and Cermak was slamming the table for silence when the front door opened and Levi Norrest stamped in. He bounded up the stairs, overcoat on, trailing snow.
Look at that! He cried, tossing a cold, snow-speckled newspaper onto the table. The Visicasters are full of it, too.
The newspaper was unfolded, and 5 heads bent over it. Cermak said in a hushed voice,
Great space! He's going to Anacreon! Going to Anacreon!
It is treason, squeaked Tarki in sudden excitement.
I'll be damned if Walto isn't right. He's sold us out, and now he's going there to collect his wage.
Cermak had risen.
We've no choice now. I'm going to ask the council tomorrow that Hardin be impeached, and if that fails...
5. The snow had ceased, but it caked the ground deeply now, and the sleek ground car advanced through the deserted streets with lumbering effort.
The murky gray light of incipient dawn was cold not only in the poetical sense, but also in a very literal way. And even in the then turbulent state of the Foundation's politics, no one, whether actionist or pro-Hardin, found his spirit sufficiently ardent to begin street activity that early. Johann Lee did not like that, and his grumblings grew audible.
"It's going to look bad, Hardin. They're going to say you sneaked away."
"Let them say it if they wish. I've got to get to Anacreon, and I want to do it without trouble. Now that's enough, Lee." Hardin leaned back into the cushioned seat and shivered slightly. It wasn't cold inside the well-heated car, but there was something frigid about a snow-covered world, even through glass, that annoyed him. He said reflectively, "Someday, when we get around to it, we ought to weather-condition Terminus. It could be done."
"I," replied Lee, "would like to see a few other things done first. For instance, what about weather-conditioning Cermak? A nice, dry cell fitted for 25 centigrade all year round would be just right."
"And then I'd really need bodyguards," said Hardin, "and not just those two." He indicated two of Lee's bully boys sitting up front with the driver, hard eyes on the empty streets, ready hands at their atom blasts. "You evidently want to stir up civil war."
"I do. There are other sticks in the fire, and it won't require much stirring, I can tell you."
He counted off on blunt fingers.
"One, Cermak raised hell yesterday in the city council and called for an impeachment."
"He had a perfect right to do so," responded Hardin coolly. "Besides which, his motion was defeated 206 to 184.
"Certainly. A majority of 22, and we had counted on 60 as a minimum. Don't deny it. You know you did."
"It was close," admitted Hardin.
"All right. And two, after the vote, the 59 members of the Actionist Party reared upon their hind legs and stamped out of the council chambers."
Hardin was silent, and Lee continued.
"And three, before leaving, Cermak howled that you were a traitor, that you were going to Anacreon to collect your 30 pieces of silver, that the chamber majority, in refusing to vote impeachment, had participated in the treason, and that the name of their party was not Actionist for nothing. What does that sound like?"
"Trouble, I suppose."
"And now you're chasing off at daybreak like a criminal. You ought to face them, Hardin, and if you have to, declare martial law by space."
"Violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. Nuts."
"All right, we'll see.
Now listen to me carefully, Lee. 30 years ago, the Time Vault opened, and on the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Foundation, there appeared a Harry Seldon recording to give us our first idea of what was really going on."
"I remember," Lee nodded reminiscently with a half-smile. "It was the day we took over the government."
"That's right. It was the time of our first major crisis. This is our second, and 3 weeks from date will be the 80th anniversary of the beginning of the Foundation. Does that strike you as in any way significant?"
"You mean he's coming again?"
"I'm not finished. Seldon never said anything about returning, you understand. But that's of a piece with his whole plan. He's always done his best to keep all foreknowledge from us. Nor is there any way of telling whether the radium lock is set for further openings short of dismantling the vault, and it's probably set to destroy itself if we were to try that. I've been there every anniversary since the first appearance, just on the chance. He's never shown up, but this is the first time since then that there's really been a crisis."
"Then he'll come."
"Maybe. I don't know. However, this is the point. At today's session of the Council, just after you announce that I have left for Anacreon, you will further announce officially that on March 14th next, there will be another Harry Seldon recording, containing a message of the utmost importance regarding the recent successfully concluded crisis. That's very important, Lee. Don't add anything more, no matter how many questions are asked." Lee stared.
"Will they believe it?"
"That doesn't matter. It will confuse them, which is all I want. Between wondering whether it is true and what I mean by it if it isn't, they'll decide to postpone action till after March 14th. I'll be back considerably before then." Lee looked uncertain.
"But that successfully concluded, that's bull."
"Highly confusing bull. Here's the airport." The waiting spaceship bulked somberly in the dimness. Hardin stamped through the snow toward it, and at the open airlock turned about with outstretched hand. "Goodbye, Lee. I hate to leave you in the frying pan like this, but there's not another I can trust. Now please keep out of the fire."
"Don't worry. The frying pan is hot enough. I'll follow orders."
He stepped back, and the airlock closed. 6. Selber Hardin did not travel to the planet Anacreon, from which planet the kingdom derived its name, immediately. It was only on the day before the coronation that he arrived, after having made flying visits to 8 of the larger stellar systems of the kingdom, stopping only long enough to confer with the local representatives of the Foundation. The trip left him with an oppressive realization of the vastness of the kingdom. It was a little splinter, an insignificant fly speck compared to the inconceivable reaches of the galactic empire of which it had once formed so distinguished a part. But to one whose habits of thought had been built around a single planet, and a sparsely settled one at that, Anacreon's size in area and population was staggering. Following closely the boundaries of the old prefect of Anacreon, it embraced 25 stellar systems, 6 of which included more than one habitable world. The population of 19 billion, though still far less than it had been in the Empire's heyday, was rising rapidly with the increasing scientific development fostered by the Foundation. And it was only now that Hardin found himself floored by the magnitude of that task. Even in 30 years, only the capital world had been powered. The outer provinces still possessed immense stretches where atomic power had not yet been reintroduced. Even the progress that had been made might have been impossible had it not been for the still workable relics left over by the ebbing tide of empire. When Hardin did arrive at the capital world, it was to find all normal business at an absolute standstill. In the outer provinces, there had been and still were celebrations. But here on the planet Anacreon, not a person but took feverish part in the hectic religious pageantry that heralded the coming of age of their god-king, Leopold. Hardin had been able to snatch only half an hour from a haggard and harried Barisov before his ambassador was forced to rush off to supervise still another temple festival. But the half hour was a most profitable one, and Hardin prepared himself for the night's fireworks, well satisfied. In all, he acted as an observer, for he had no stomach for the religious tasks he would undoubtedly have had to undertake if his identity became known. So when the palace's ballroom filled itself with a glittering horde of the kingdom's very highest and most exalted nobility, he found himself hugging the wall, little noticed or totally ignored. He had been introduced to Leopold as one of a long line of introducees, and from a safe distance, for the king stood apart in lonely and impressive grandeur, surrounded by his deadly blaze of radioactive aura. And in less than an hour, this same king would take his seat upon the massive throne of rhodium-iridium alloy, with jewel-set gold chasings, and then, throne and all, would rise majestically into the air, skim the ground slowly to hover before the great window from which the great crowds of common folk could see their king and shout themselves into near apoplexy. The throne would not have been so massive, of course, if it had not had an atomic motor built into it. It was past 11. Hardin fidgeted and stood on his toes to better his view. He resisted an impulse to stand on a chair. And then he saw Venus threading through the crowd toward him, and he relaxed. Venus' progress was slow. At almost every step, he had to pass a kindly sentence with some revered noble whose grandfather had helped Leopold's grandfather brigandize the kingdom, and had received a dukedom, therefore. And then he disentangled himself from the last uniformed peer and reached Hardin. His smile crooked itself into a smirk, and his black eyes peered from under grizzled brows with glints of satisfaction in them. "My dear Hardin," he said in a low voice, "you must expect to be bored when you refuse to announce your identity." "I'm not bored, Your Highness. This is all extremely interesting. We have no comparable spectacles on Terminus, you know." "No doubt. But would you care to step into my private chambers, where we can speak at greater length and with considerably more privacy?"
"Certainly."
With arms linked, the two ascended the staircase, and more than one dowager duchess raised her lorgnette in surprise and wonder at the identity of this insignificantly dressed and uninteresting-looking stranger on whom such signal honor was being conferred by the Prince Regent. In Wina's chambers, Hardin relaxed in perfect comfort and accepted with a murmur of gratitude the glass of liquor that had been poured out by the Regent's own hand. "Locrice wine, Hardin," said Wina, "from the royal cellars. The real thing, 2 centuries in age. It was laid down 10 years before the Zionian rebellion." "A really royal drink," agreed Hardin politely. "To Leopold I, King of Anacreon." They drank, and Venus added blandly at the pause, "And soon to be Emperor of the Periphery, and further, who knows? The galaxy may someday be reunited."
"Undoubtedly. By Anacreon?"
"Why not? With the help of the Foundation, our scientific superiority over the rest of the Periphery would be indisputable."
Hardin set his empty glass down and said, "Well, yes, except that, of course, the Foundation is bound to help any nation that requests scientific aid of it. Due to the high idealism of our government and the great moral purpose of our founder, Harry Seldon, we are unable to play favorites. That can't be helped, Your Highness."
Wina's smile broadened. "The galactic spirit, to use the popular cant, helps those who help themselves. I quite understand that, left to itself, the Foundation would never cooperate."
"I wouldn't say that. We repaired the Imperial cruiser for you, though my Board of Navigation wished it for themselves for research purposes."
The Regent repeated the last words ironically. "Research purposes, yes. Yet you would not have repaired it had I not threatened war."
Hardin made a deprecatory gesture. "I don't know."
"I do," and that threat always stood. And still stands now? Now it is rather too late to speak of threats.
Weenus had cast a rapid glance at the clock on his desk.
Look here, Harden. You were on Anacreon once before. You were young then. We were both young. But even then we had entirely different ways of looking at things. You're what they call a man of peace, aren't you?
I suppose I am. At least I consider violence an uneconomical way of attaining an end. There are always better substitutes, though they may sometimes be a little less direct.
Yes, I've heard of your famous remark, violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. And yet, the regent scratched one ear gently in affected abstraction, I wouldn't call myself exactly incompetent.
Harden nodded politely and said nothing.
And in spite of that, Weenus continued, I've always believed in direct action. I have believed in carving a straight path to my objective and following that path. I have accomplished much that way and fully expect to accomplish still more.
I know, interrupted Harden. I believe you were carving a path such as you described for yourself and your children that leads directly to the throne, considering the late unfortunate death of the king's father, your elder brother, and the king's own precarious state of health. He is in a precarious state of health, is he not?
Weenus frowned at the shot, and his voice grew harder. You might find it advisable, Harden, to avoid certain subjects. You may consider yourself privileged as mayor of Terminus to make injudicious remarks, but if you do, please disabuse yourself of the notion. I am not one to be frightened at words. It has been my philosophy of life that difficulties vanish when faced boldly, and I have never turned my back upon one yet.
I don't doubt that. What particular difficulty are you refusing to turn your back upon at the present moment?
The difficulty, Harden, of persuading the Foundation to cooperate. Your policy of peace, you see, has led you into making several very serious mistakes, simply because you underestimated the boldness of your adversary. Not everyone is as afraid of direct action as you are.
For instance, suggested Harden.
For instance, you came to Anacreon alone and accompanied me to my chambers alone.
Harden looked about him. And what is wrong with that?
Nothing, said the regent, except that outside this room are 5 police guards, well armed and ready to shoot. I don't think you can leave, Harden.
The mayor's eyebrows lifted.
I have no immediate desire to leave.
Do you then fear me so much?
I don't fear you at all, but this may serve to impress you with my determination. Shall we call it a gesture?
Call it what you please, said Harden indifferently. I shall not discommode myself over the incident, whatever you choose to call it.
I'm sure that attitude will change with time. But you have made another error, Harden, a more serious one. It seems that the planet Terminus is almost wholly undefended.
Naturally. What have we to fear? We threaten no one's interest and serve all alike.
And while remaining helpless, Weenus went on, you kindly helped us to arm ourselves, aiding us particularly in the development of a navy of our own, a great navy. In fact, a navy which, since your donation of the Imperial cruiser, is quite irresistible.
Your Highness, you are wasting time. Harden made as if to rise from his seat. If you mean to declare war and are informing me of the fact, you will allow me to communicate with my government at once.
Sit down, Harden. I am not declaring war, and you are not communicating with your government at all. When the war is fought, not declared, Harden, fought, the Foundation will be informed of it in due time by the atom blasts of the Anacreonian Navy under the lead of my own son upon the flagship Weenus, once a cruiser of the Imperial Navy.
Harden frowned. When will all this happen?
If you're really interested, the ships of the fleet left Anacreon exactly 50 minutes ago at 11, and the first shot will be fired as soon as they sight Terminus, which should be at noon tomorrow. You may consider yourself a prisoner of war.
That's exactly what I do consider myself, Your Highness, said Harden, still frowning. But I'm disappointed.
Weenus chuckled contemptuously. Is that all?
Yes. I had thought that the moment of coronation, midnight, you know, would be the logical time to set the fleet in motion. Evidently, you wanted to start the war while you were still regent.
It would have been more dramatic the other way.
The regent stared.
What in space are you talking about?
Don't you understand? Said Harden softly. I had set my counterstroke for midnight.
Weenus started from his chair. You are not bluffing me. There is no counterstroke. If you are counting on the support of the other kingdoms, forget it. Their navies combined are no match for ours.
I know that. I don't intend firing a shot. It is simply that the word went out a week ago that at midnight tonight the planet Anacreon goes under the interdict.
The interdict?
Yes.
If you don't understand, I might explain that every priest in Anacreon is going on strike, unless I countermand the order. But I can't while I'm being held incommunicado, nor do I wish to, even if I weren't. He leaned forward and added with sudden animation, Do you realize, Your Highness, that an attack on the Foundation is nothing short of sacrilege of the highest order? Weenus was groping visibly for self-control.
You mean none of that, Harden. Save it for the mob.
My dear Weenus, whoever do you think I am saving it for?
I imagine that for the last half hour every temple on Anacreon has been the center of a mob, listening to a priest exhorting them upon that very subject. There's not a man or woman on Anacreon that doesn't know that their government has launched a vicious, unprovoked attack upon the center of their religion. But it lacks only 4 minutes of midnight now. You'd better go down to the ballroom to watch events. I'll be safe here with 5 guards outside the door. He leaned back in his chair, helped himself to another glass of Locrice wine, and gazed at the ceiling with perfect indifference. Weenus blistered the air with a muffled oath and rushed out of the room. A hush had fallen over the elite in the ballroom as a broad path was cleared for the throne. Leopold sat on it now, hands solidly on its arms, head high, face frozen. The huge chandeliers had dimmed, and in the diffused, multicolored light from the tiny atomo bulbs that bespangled the vaulted ceiling, the royal aura shone out bravely, lifting high above his head to form a blazing coronet. Weenus paused on the stairway. No one saw him. All eyes were on the throne. He clenched his fist and remained where he was. Harden would not bluff him into silly action. And then the throne stirred. Noiselessly it lifted upward and drifted. Off the dais, slowly down the steps, and then, horizontally, 6 inches off the floor, it worked itself toward the huge open window. At the sound of the deep-toned bell that signified midnight, it stopped before the window, and the king's aura died. For a frozen split second, the king did not move, face twisted in surprise, without an aura, merely human. And then the throne wobbled and fell the 6 inches to the floor with a crashing thump, just as every light in the palace went out. Through the shrieking din and confusion, Weenus's bull voice sounded, Get the flares! Get the flares! He buffeted right and left through the crowd and forced his way to the door. From without, palace guards had streamed into the darkness. Somehow the flares were brought back to the ballroom, flares that were to have been used in the gigantic torchlight procession through the streets of the city after the coronation. Back to the ballroom, guardsmen swarmed with torches, blue, green, and red, where the strange light lit up frightened, confused faces.
There is no harm done, shouted Weenus. Keep your places. Power will return in a moment.
He turned to the captain of the guard, who stood stiffly at attention.
What is it, Captain?
Your Highness, was the instant response. The palace is surrounded by the people of the city.
What do they want? Snarled Weenus.
A priest is at the head. He has been identified as High Priest Polly Verisov. He demands the immediate release of Mayor Selvar Harden and the cessation of the war against the Foundation. The report was made in the expressionless tones of an officer, but his eyes shifted uneasily. Weenus cried,
If any of the rabble attempt to pass the palace gates, blast them out of existence. For the moment, nothing more. Let them howl. There'll be an accounting tomorrow.
The torches had been distributed now, and the ballroom was again alight. Weenus rushed to the throne, still standing by the window, and dragged the stricken, wax-faced Leopold to his feet.
Come with me.
He cast one look out of the window. The city was pitch black. From below, there were the hoarse, confused cries of the mob. Only toward the right, where the Argolid temple stood, was their illumination. He swore angrily and dragged the king away. Weenus burst into his chambers, the 5 guardsmen at his heels. Leopold followed, wide-eyed, scared, speechless.
Harden, said Weenus huskily, you are playing with forces too great for you.
The mayor ignored the speaker. In the pearly light of the pocket atomo bulb at his side, he remained quietly seated, a slightly ironic smile on his face.
"'Good morning, Your Majesty,' he said to Leopold. "'I congratulate you on your coronation.'
"'Harden,' cried Weenus again, "'order your priests back to their jobs.'
"'Harden looked up coolly. "'Order them yourself, Weenus, "'and see who is playing with forces too great for whom. "'Right now there's not a wheel turning in Anacreon. "'There's not a light burning except in the temples. "'There's not a drop of water running except in the temples. "'On the wintry half of the planet "'there's not a calorie of heat except in the temples.' The hospitals are taking in no more patients. The power plants have shut down. All ships are grounded. If you don't like it, Weenus, you can order the priests back to their jobs. I don't wish to.
By space, Harden, I will. If it's to be a showdown, so be it. We'll see if your priests can withstand the army. Tonight, every temple on the planet will be put under army supervision.
Very good. But
But how are you going to give the orders? Every line of communication on the planet is shut down. You'll find that radio won't work, and the televisors won't work, and the ultrawave won't work. In fact, the only communicator of the planet that will work, outside of the temples, of course, is the televisor right here in this room, and I fitted it only for reception. Weenus struggled vainly for breath, and Hardin continued, If you wish, you can order your army into the Argolid Temple just outside the palace, and then use the ultrawave sets there to contact other portions of the planet. But if you do that, I'm afraid the army contingent will be cut to pieces by the mob, and then what will protect your palace, Weenus? And your lives, Weenus?
Weenus said thickly, We can hold out, devil. We'll last the day. Let the mob howl and let the power die, but we'll hold out. And when the news comes back that the Foundation has been taken, your precious mob will find upon what vacuum their religion has been built, and they'll desert your priests and turn against them. I give you until noon tomorrow, Hardin, because you can stop the power on Anacreon, but you can't stop my fleet.
His voice croaked exultantly.
They're on their way, Hardin, with a great cruiser you yourself ordered repaired at the head.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Hardin replied lightly, Yes, the cruiser I myself ordered repaired, but in my own way. Tell me, Weenus, have you ever heard of an ultra-wave relay? No, I see you haven't. Well, in about 2 minutes, you'll find out what one can do. The televisor flashed to life as he spoke, and he amended, No, in 2 seconds. Sit down, Weenus, and listen. 7. Theo Apparat was one of the very highest-ranking priests of Anacreon. From the standpoint of precedence alone, he deserved his appointment as head priest attendant upon the flagship Weenus. But it was not only rank or precedence. He knew the ship. He had worked directly under the holy men from the Foundation itself in repairing the ship. He had gone over the motors under their orders. He had rewired the visors, revamped the communication system, replated the punctured hull, reinforced the beams. He had even been permitted to help while the wise men of the Foundation had installed a device so holy it had never been placed in any previous ship, but had been reserved only for this magnificent colossus of a vessel, the ultra-wave relay. It was no wonder that he felt heartsick over the purposes to which the glorious ship was perverted. He had never wanted to believe what Barisov had told him, that the ship was to be used for appalling wickedness, that its guns were to be turned on the great Foundation. Turned on that Foundation where he had been trained as a youth, from which all blessedness was derived. Yet he could not doubt now after what the Admiral had told him. How could the King, divinely blessed, allow this abominable act? Or was it the King? Was it not perhaps an action of the accursed Regent Weenus, without the knowledge of the King at all? And it was the son of this same Weenus that was the Admiral who 5 minutes before had told him, Attend to your souls and your blessings, priest. I will attend to my ship. Apparat smiled crookedly. He would attend to his souls and his blessings, and also to his cursings, and Prince Lefkin would whine soon enough. He had entered the general communications room now. His acolyte preceded him, and the two officers in charge made no move to interfere. The head priest attendant had the right of free entry anywhere on the ship. Close the door, Apparat ordered, and looked at the chronometer. It lacked 12:05. He had timed it well. With quick, practiced motions, he moved the little levers that opened all communications, so that every part of the 2-mile-long ship was within reach of his voice and his image. Soldiers of the Royal Flagship Weenus, attend. It is your priest attendant that speaks. The sound of his voice reverberated, he knew, from the stern atom blast in the extreme rear to the navigation tables in the prow. Your ship, he cried, is engaged in sacrilege. Without your knowledge, it is performing such an act as will doom the soul of every man among you to the eternal frigidity of space. Listen, it is the intention of your commander to take this ship to the Foundation, and there to bombard that source of all blessings into submission to his sinful will. And since that is his intention, I, in the name of the Galactic Spirit, remove him from his command, for there is no command where the blessing of the Galactic Spirit has been withdrawn. The Divine King himself may not maintain his kingship without the consent of the Spirit. His voice took on a deeper tone while the acolyte listened with veneration and the 2 soldiers with mounting fear. And because this ship is upon such a devil's errand, the blessing of the Spirit is removed from it as well. He lifted his arms solemnly, and before 1,000 televisors throughout the ship, soldiers cowered as the stately image of their priest attendant spoke.
In the name of the Galactic Spirit and of his prophet Harry Seldon, and of his interpreters, the holy men of the Foundation, I curse this ship. Let the televisors of this ship, which are its eyes, become blind. Let its grapples, which are its arms, be paralyzed. Let the atom blasts, which are its fists, lose their function. Let the motors, which are its heart, cease to beat. Let the communications, which are its voice, become dumb. Let its ventilations, which are its breath, fade. Let its lights, which are its soul, shrivel into nothing. In the name of the Galactic Spirit, I so curse this ship.
And with his last word, at the stroke of midnight, a hand, light years distant in the Argolid Temple, opened an ultrawave relay, which, at the instantaneous speed of the ultrawave, opened another on the flagship Venus. And the ship died. For it is the chief characteristic of the religion of science that it works, and that such curses as that of Apparat's are really deadly. Apparat saw the darkness close down on the ship and heard the sudden ceasing of the soft, distant purring of the hyperatomic motors. He exulted, and from the pocket of his long robe withdrew a self-powered atomo bulb that filled the room with pearly light. He looked down at the two soldiers, who, brave men though they undoubtedly were, writhed on their knees in the last extremity of mortal terror. "Save our souls, your reverence. We are poor men, ignorant of the crimes of our leaders," one whimpered. "Follow," said Apparat sternly. "Your soul is not yet lost." The ship was a turmoil of darkness in which fear was so thick and palpable it was all but a miasmic smell. Soldiers crowded close wherever Apparat and his circle of light passed, striving to touch the hem of his robe, pleading for the tiniest scrap of mercy. And always his answer was, "Follow me." He found Prince Lefkin groping his way through the officers' quarters, cursing loudly for lights. The admiral stared at the priest attendant with hating eyes. "There you are," Lefkin inherited his blue eyes from his mother, but there was that about the hook in his nose and the squint in his eye that marked him as the son of Venus. "What is the meaning of your treasonable actions? Return the power to the ship. I am commander here."
"No longer," said Apparat somberly.
Lefkin looked about wildly.
"Seize that man. Arrest him, or by space I will send every man within reach of my voice out the airlock in the Nude."
He paused and then shrieked,
"It is your admiral that orders. Arrest him!"
Then, as he lost his head entirely,
"Are you allowing yourselves to be fooled by this mountebank, this harlequin? Do you cringe before a religion compounded of clouds and moonbeams? This man is an impostor, and the galactic spirit he speaks of, a fraud of the imagination devised to—"
Apparat interrupted furiously. "Seize the blasphemer. You listen to him at the peril of your souls." And promptly the noble admiral went down under the clutching hands of a score of soldiers. "Take him with you and follow me." Apparat turned, and with Lefkin dragged along after him and the corridors behind black with soldiery, he returned to the communications room. There he ordered the ex-commander before the one televisor that worked. "Order the rest of the fleet to seize course and prepare for the return to Anacreon." The disheveled Lefkin, bleeding, beaten, and half-stunned, did so. "And now," continued Apparat grimly, "we are in contact with Anacreon and the ultrawave beam. Speak as I order you." Lefkin made a gesture of negation, and the mob in the room, and the others crowding the corridor beyond, growled fearfully. "Speak," said Apparat. "Begin." "The Anacreonian Navy..." Lefkin began. 8. There was absolute silence in Venus Chambers when the image of Prince Lefkin appeared at the televisor. There had been one startled gasp from the regent at the haggard face and shredded uniform of his son. Then he collapsed into a chair, face contorted with surprise and apprehension. Hardin listened stolidly, hands clasped lightly in his lap, while the just-crowned King Leopold sat shriveled in the most shadowy corner, biting spasmodically at his gold-braided sleeve. Even the soldiers had lost the emotionless stare that is the prerogative of the military, and from where they lined up against the door, atom blasts ready, peered furtively at the figure upon the televisor. Lefkin spoke, reluctantly, with a tired voice that paused at intervals as though he were being prompted, and not gently. "The Anacreonian Navy, aware of the nature of its mission, and refusing to be a party to abominable sacrilege, is returning to Anacreon with the following ultimatum issued. To those blaspheming sinners who would dare to use profane force against the Foundation, source of all blessings, and against the Galactic Spirit, cease at once all war against the true faith, and guarantee in a manner suiting us of the Navy, as represented by our priest-attendant, Theo Apparat, that such war will never, in the future, be resumed, and that—" Here a long pause, then continuing, "and that the one-time Prince Regent Venus
be imprisoned and tried before an ecclesiastical court for his crimes. Otherwise, the Royal Navy, upon returning to Anacreon, will blast the palace to the ground and take whatever other measures are necessary to destroy the nest of sinners and the den of destroyers of men's souls that now prevail. The voice ended with half a sob, and the screen went blank. Hardin's fingers passed rapidly over the atomo bulb, and its light faded until, in the dimness, the hitherto regent, the king, and the soldiers were hazy-edged shadows, and for the first time it could be seen that an aura encompassed Hardin. It was not the blazing light that was the prerogative of kings, but one less spectacular, less impressive, and yet one more effective in its own way, and more useful. Hardin's voice was softly ironic as he addressed the same Venus who had, 1 hour earlier, declared him a prisoner of war and Terminus on the point of destruction, and who now was a huddled shadow, broken and silent. "There is an old fable," said Hardin, "as old perhaps as humanity, for the oldest records containing it are merely copies of other records still older that might interest you. It runs as follows. A horse, having a wolf as a powerful and dangerous enemy, lived in constant fear of his life. Being driven to desperation, it occurred to him to seek a strong ally. Whereupon he approached a man and offered an alliance, pointing out that the wolf was likewise an enemy of the man. The man accepted the partnership at once and offered to kill the wolf immediately if his new partner would only cooperate by placing his greater speed at the man's disposal. The horse was willing and allowed the man to place bridle and saddle upon him. The man mounted, hunted down the wolf, and killed him. The horse, joyful and relieved, thanked the man and said, 'Now that our enemy is dead, remove your bridle and saddle and restore my freedom.' Whereupon the man laughed loudly and replied, 'The hell you say, giddy up, Dobbin,' and applied the spurs with a will." Silence still. The shadow that was Venus did not stir. Hardin continued quietly. "You see the analogy, I hope. In their anxiety to cement forever total domination over their own people, the kings of the four kingdoms accepted the religion of science that made them divine, and that same religion of science was their bridle and saddle, for it placed the lifeblood of atomic power in the hands of the priesthood, who took their orders from us, be it noted, and not from you. You killed the wolf, but could not get rid of them." Venus sprang to his feet, and in the shadows his eyes were maddened hollows. His voice was thick, incoherent.
"Yes, I'll get you. You won't escape. You'll rot. Let them blow us up. Let them blow everything up. You'll rot. I'll get you. Soldiers," he thundered hysterically, "shoot me down, that devil. Blast him. Blast him."
Hardin turned about in his chair to face the soldiers and smiled. One aimed his atom blast and then lowered it. The others never budged. Salber Hardin, mayor of Terminus, surrounded by that soft aura, smiling so confidently, and before whom all the power of Anacreon had crumbled to powder, was too much for them, despite the orders of the shrieking maniac just beyond. Venus screamed a curse and staggered to the nearest soldier. Wildly he wrested the atom blast from the man's hand, aimed it at Hardin, who didn't stir, shoved the lever, and held it contacted. The pale, continuous beam impinged upon the force field that surrounded the mayor of Terminus, and was sucked harmlessly to neutralization. Venus pressed harder and laughed tearingly. Hardin still smiled, and his force field aura scarcely brightened as it absorbed the energies of the atom blast. From his corner, Leopold covered his eyes and moaned. And with a yell of despair, Venus changed his aim and shot again, and toppled to the floor with his head blown into nothingness. Hardin winced at the sight and muttered, "A man of direct action to the end. The last refuge." 9. The time vault was filled far beyond the available seating capacity, and men lined the back of the room three deep. Salver Hardin compared this large company with the few men attending the first appearance of Harry Seldon 30 years earlier. There had only been 6 then, the 5 old encyclopedists, all dead now, and himself, the young figurehead of a mayor. It had been on that day that he, with Johann Lee's assistance, had removed the figurehead stigma from his office. It was quite different now, different in every respect. Every man of the city council was awaiting Seldon's appearance. He himself was still mayor, but all-powerful now, and since the utter rout of Anacreon, all-popular. When he had returned from Anacreon with the news of the death of Venus and the new treaty signed with the trembling Leopold, he was greeted with a vote of confidence of shrieking unanimity. When this was followed in rapid order by similar treaties signed with each of the other three kingdoms, treaties that gave the Foundation powers such as would forever prevent any attempts at attack similar to that of Anacreon's, torchlight processions had been held in every city street of Terminus. Not even Harry Seldon's name had been more loudly cheered. Hardin's lips twitched. Such popularity had been his after the first crisis also. Across the room, Seth Cermak and Louis Bort were engaged in animated discussion, and recent events seemed to have put them out not at all. They had joined in the vote of confidence, made speeches in which they publicly admitted that they had been in the wrong, apologized handsomely for the use of certain phrases in earlier debates, excused themselves delicately by declaring they had merely followed the dictates of their judgment and their conscience, and immediately launched a new actionist campaign. Johann Lee touched Hardin's sleeve and pointed significantly to his watch. Hardin looked up. "Hello, Lee. You still sour? What's wrong now?"
"He's due in 5 minutes, isn't he?"
"I presume so. He appeared at noon last time."
"What if he doesn't?"
"Are you going to wear me down with your worries all your life? If he doesn't, he won't." Lee frowned and shook his head slowly.
"If this thing flops, we're in another mess. Without Seldon's backing for what we've done, Cermak will be free to start all over. He wants outright annexation of the Four Kingdoms and immediate expansion of the Foundation, by force if necessary. He's begun his campaign already."
"I know. A fire-eater must eat fire even if he has to kindle it himself. And you, Lee, have got to worry, even if you must kill yourself to invent something to worry about." Lee would have answered, but he lost his breath at just that moment, as the lights yellowed and went dim. He raised his arm to point to the glass cubicle that dominated half the room, and then collapsed into a chair with a windy sigh. Hardin himself straightened at the sight of the figure that now filled the cubicle, a figure in a wheelchair. He alone, of all those present, could remember the day, decades ago, when that figure had appeared first. He had been young then, and the figure old. Since then, the figure had not aged a day, but he himself had in turn grown old. The figure stared straight ahead, hands fingering a book in its lap. It said, "I am Harry Seldon." The voice was old and soft. There was a breathless silence in the room, and Harry Seldon continued conversationally. "This is the second time I've been here. Of course, I don't know if any of you were here the first time. In fact, I have no way of telling by sense perception that there is anyone here at all, but that doesn't matter. If the second crisis has been overcome safely, you are bound to be here. There is no way out. If you are not here, then the second crisis has been too much for you." He smiled engagingly. "I doubt that, however, for my figures show a 98.4% probability there is to be no significant deviation from the plan in the first 80 years. According to our calculations, you have now reached domination of the barbarian kingdoms immediately surrounding the Foundation. Just as in the first crisis you held them off by the use of the balance of power, so in the second you gained mastery by the use of the spiritual power as against the temporal. However, I might warn you here against overconfidence. It is not my way to grant you any foreknowledge in these recordings, but it would be safe to indicate that what you have now achieved is merely a new balance, the one in which your position is considerably better. The spiritual power, while sufficient to ward off attacks of the temporal, is not sufficient to attack in turn. Because of the invariable growth of the counteracting force known as regionalism or nationalism, the spiritual power cannot prevail. I'm telling you nothing new, I'm sure. You must pardon me, by the way, for speaking to you in this vague way. The terms I used are at best mere approximations, but none of you is qualified to understand the true symbology of psychohistory, and so I must do the best I can. In this case, the Foundation is only at the start of the path that leads to new empire. The neighboring kingdoms, in manpower and resources, are still overwhelmingly powerful as compared to yourselves. Outside them lies the vast, tangled jungle of barbarism that extends around the entire breadth of the galaxy. Within that rim, there is still what is left of the Galactic Empire, and that, weakened and decaying though it is still incomparably mighty. At this point, Harry Seldon lifted his book and opened it. His face grew solemn. "And never forget, there was another Foundation established 80 years ago, a Foundation at the other end of the galaxy, at Star's End. They will always be there for consideration. Gentlemen, 920 years of the plan stretch ahead of you. The problem is yours. Go to it." He dropped his eyes to his book and flicked out of existence, while the lights brightened to fullness. In the babble that followed, Lee leaned over to Hardin's ear.
He didn't say when he'd be back.
Hardin replied, I know, but I trust that he won't return until you and I are safely and cozily dead. Part 4. The Traitors. 1. Traitors. And constantly in advance of the political hegemony of the Foundation were the traitors, reaching out tenuous finger holds through the tremendous distances of the periphery. Months or years might pass between landings on Terminus. Their ships were often nothing more than patchquilts of homemade repairs and improvisations. Their honesty was none of the highest. Their daring... Through it all, they forged an empire more enduring than the pseudo-religious despotism of the Four Kingdoms. Tales without end are told of these massive, lonely figures who bore half-seriously, half-mockingly, a motto adopted from one of Salvar Hardin's epigrams. Never let your sense of morals prevent you from doing what is right. It is difficult now to tell which tales are real and which apocryphal. There are none, probably, that have not suffered some exaggeration. Encyclopedia Galactica. Limmer Ponyitz was completely alather when the call reached his receiver, which proves that the old bromide about telemessages in the bathtub holds true even in the dark, hard space of the galactic periphery. Luckily, that part of a freelance trade ship which is not given over to miscellaneous merchandise is extremely snug, so much so that the shower, hot water included, is located in a 2x4 cubby 10 feet from the control panels. Ponyitz heard the staccato rattle of the receiver quite plainly. Dripping suds and a curse, he stepped out to adjust the vocal, and 3 hours later a second trade ship was alongside, and a grinning youngster entered through the air tube between the ships. Ponyitz rattled his best chair forward and perched himself on the pilot's wheel. "What have you been doing, Gorm?" he asked darkly. "Chasing me all the way from the Foundation?" Les Gorm broke out a cigarette and shook his head definitely. "Me? Not a chance. I'm just the sucker who happened to land on Gliptol 4 the day after the mail, so they sent me out after you with this." The tiny, gleaming sphere changed hands, and Gorm added, "It's confidential. Super secret. Can't be trusted to the sub-ether and all that, or so I gather. At least it's a personal capsule and won't open for anyone but you." Ponyitz regarded the capsule distastefully. "I can see that, and I never knew one of these to hold good news, either." It opened in his hand, and the thin, transparent tape unrolled stiffly. His eyes swept the message quickly, for when the last of the tape had emerged, the first was already brown and crinkled. In a minute and a half it had turned black, and molecule by molecule fallen apart. Ponyitz grunted hollowly. "Oh, galaxy." Les Gorm said quietly, "Can I help somehow, or is it too secret?" "It'll bear telling, since you're of the guild. I've got to go to Ascone." "That place? How come?" "They've imprisoned a traitor, but keep it to yourself." Gorm's expression jolted into anger. "Imprisoned? That's against the convention." "So was interference with local politics." "Oh, is that what he did?" Gorm meditated. "Who's the traitor? Anyone I know?" "No," said Ponyitz sharply, and Gorm accepted the implication and asked no further questions. Ponyitz was up and staring darkly out the visiplate. He mumbled strong expressions at that part of the misty lens form that was the body of the galaxy, then said loudly, "Damnedest mess. I'm way behind quota." Light broke on Gorm's intellect. "Hey, friend, Ascone's a closed area." "That's right. You can't sell as much as a penknife on Ascone. They won't buy atomic gadgets of any sort. With my quota dead on its feet, it's murder to go there." "Can't get out of it?" Ponyitz shook his head absently. "I know the fellow involved. Can't walk out on a friend. What of it? I am in the hands of the galactic spirit and walk cheerfully in the way he points out." Gorm said blankly, "Huh?" Ponyitz looked at him and laughed shortly. "I forgot. You never read the Book of the Spirit, did you?" "Never heard of it," said Gorm curtly. "Well, you would if you'd had a religious training." "Religious training? For the priesthood?" Gorm was profoundly shocked. "Afraid so. It's my dark shame and secret. I was too much for the revered fathers, though. They expelled me for reasons sufficient to promote me to a secular education under the Foundation." "Well, look, I'd better push off. How's your quota this year?" Gorm crushed out his cigarette and adjusted his cap. "I've got my last cargo going now. I'll make it." "Lucky fellow," gloomed Ponyitz. And for many minutes after Les Gorm left, he sat in a motionless reverie. So Eskil Gorov was on Ascone, and in prison as well. That was bad. In fact, considerably worse than it might appear. It was one thing to tell a curious youngster a diluted version of the business to throw him off and send him about his own. It was a thing of a different sort to face the truth. For Limmer Ponyitz was one of the few people who happened to know that Master Trader Eskil Gorov was not a traitor at all, but that entirely different thing, an agent of the Foundation. 2 weeks gone, 2 weeks wasted. 1 week to reach Ascone, at the extreme borders of which the vigilant warships speared out to meet him in converging numbers. Whatever their detection system was, it worked, and well. They sidled him in slowly, without a signal, maintaining their cold distance, and pointing him harshly towards the central sun of Ascone. Ponyats could have handled them at a pinch. Those ships were holdovers from the dead-and-gone Galactic Empire, but they were sports cruisers, not warships, and without atomic weapons, they were so many picturesque and impotent ellipsoids. But Eskogorov was a prisoner in their hands, and Gorov was not a hostage to lose. The Asconians must know that. And then another week. A week to wind a weary way through the clouds of minor officials that formed the buffer between the Grand Master and the outer world. Each little subsecretary required soothing and conciliation. Each required careful and nauseating milking for the flourishing signature that was the pathway to the next official, one higher up. For the first time, Ponyats found his traitor's identification papers useless. Now, at last, the Grand Master was on the other side of the guard-flanked gilded door, and 2 weeks had gone. Gorov was still a prisoner, and Ponyats' cargo rotted useless in the holds of his ship. The Grand Master was a small man with a balding head and very wrinkled face, whose body seemed weighed down to motionlessness by the huge glossy fur collar about his neck. His fingers moved on either side, and the line of armed men backed away to form a passage, along which Ponyats strode to the foot of the chair of state. "Don't speak," snapped the Grand Master, and Ponyats's opening lips closed tightly. "That's right," the Asconian ruler relaxed visibly. "I can't endure useless chatter. You cannot threaten, and I won't abide flattery. Nor is there room for injured complaints. I have lost count of the times you wanderers have been warned that your devil's machines are not wanted anywhere in Ascone." "Sir," said Ponyats quietly, "there is no attempt to justify the traitor in question. It is not the policy of traitors to intrude where they are not wanted. But the galaxy is great, and it has happened before that a boundary has been trespassed unwittingly. It was a deplorable mistake." "Deplorable, certainly," squeaked the Grand Master. "But mistake? Your people on Gliptol 4 have been bombarding me with pleas for negotiation since 2 hours after the sacrilegious wretch was seized. I have been warned by them of your own coming many times over. It seems a well-organized rescue campaign. Much seems to have been anticipated, a little too much for mistakes, deplorable or otherwise." The Asconian's black eyes were scornful. He raced on. "And are you traitors, flitting from world to world like mad little butterflies, so mad in your own right that you can land on Ascone's largest world, in the center of its system, and consider it an unwitting boundary mix-up? Come, surely not." Ponyats winced without showing it. He said doggedly, "If the attempt to trade was deliberate, Your Veneration, it was most injudicious and contrary to the strictest regulations of our guild."
"Injudicious, yes," said the Asconian curtly. "So much so that your comrade is likely to lose life in payment."
Ponyat's stomach knotted. There was no irresolution there. He said, "Death, Your Veneration, is so absolute and irrevocable a phenomenon that certainly there must be some alternative." There was a pause before the guarded answer came.
"I have heard that the Foundation is rich."
"Rich, certainly. But our riches are that which you refuse to take."
"Our atomic goods are worth—" "Your goods are worthless in that they lack the ancestral blessing. Your goods are wicked and accursed in that they lie under the ancestral interdict."
The sentences were intoned, the recitation of a formula. The Grand Master's eyelids dropped, and he said with meaning,
"You have nothing else of value?"
The meaning was lost on the trader.
"I don't understand. What is it you want?"
The Asconian's hands spread apart.
"You ask me to trade places with you and make known to you my wants. I think not. Your colleague, it seems, must suffer the punishment set for sacrilege by the Asconian code, death by gas. We are a just people. The poorest peasant in like case would suffer no more. I myself would suffer no less."
Ponyats mumbled hopelessly, "Your Veneration, would it be permitted that I speak to the prisoner?"
"Asconian law," said the Grand Master coldly, "allows no communication with a condemned man."
Mentally, Ponyats held his breath. "Your Veneration, I ask you to be merciful towards a man's soul, in the hour when his body stands forfeit. He has been separated from spiritual consolation in all the time that his life has been in danger. Even now, he faces the prospect of going unprepared to the bosom of the spirit that rules all." This book is continued on cassette number 5, side 1. The Grand Master said slowly and suspiciously,
"You are a tender of the soul?"
Ponyats dropped a humble head.
I have been so trained. In the empty expanses of space, the wandering traders need men like myself to care for the spiritual side of a life so given over to commerce and worldly pursuits. The Asconian ruler sucked thoughtfully at his lower lip. Every man should prepare his soul for his journey to his ancestral spirits, yet I had never thought you traders to be believers. 3. Eskogorov stirred on his couch and opened one eye as Limar Panyets entered the heavily reinforced door. It boomed shut behind him. Gorov sputtered and came to his feet.
Panyets, they sent you?
Pure chance, said Panyets bitterly. Or the work of my own personal malevolent demon. Item 1, you get into a mess on Ascone. Item 2, my sales route, as known to the Board of Trade, carries me within 50 parsecs of the system at just the time of item 1. Item 3, we've worked together before and the board knows it. Isn't that a sweet, inevitable setup? The answer just pops out of a slot.
Be careful, said Gorov tautly. There'll be someone listening. Are you wearing a field distorter?
Panyets indicated the ornamented bracelet that hugged his wrist, and Gorov relaxed. Panyets looked about him. The cell was bare, but large. It was well lit, and it lacked offensive odors. He said,
Not bad. They're treating you with kid gloves.
Gorov brushed the remark aside.
Listen, how did you get down here? I've been in strict solitary for almost 2 weeks.
Ever since I came, huh? Well, it seems the old bird who's boss here has his weak points. He leans toward pious speeches, so I took a chance that worked. I'm here in the capacity of your spiritual advisor. There's something about a pious man such as he. He will cheerfully cut your throat if it suits him, but he will hesitate to endanger the welfare of your immaterial and problematical soul. It's just a piece of empirical psychology. A trader has to know a little of everything.
Gorov's smile was sardonic. And you've been to theological school as well.
You're all right, Panyets. I'm glad they sent you. But the Grand Master doesn't love my soul exclusively. Has he mentioned a ransom? The trader's eyes narrowed. He hinted, barely, and he also threatened death by gas. I played safe and dodged. It might easily have been a trap. So it's extortion, is it? What is it he wants?
Gold.
Gold? Panyets frowned. The metal itself? What for?
It's their medium of exchange.
Is it? And where do I get gold from?
Wherever you can. Listen to me. This is important. Nothing will happen to me as long as the Grand Master has the scent of gold in his nose. Promise it to him, as much as he asks for. Then go back to the Foundation, if necessary, to get it. When I'm free, we'll be escorted out of the system, and then we part company.
Panyets stared disapprovingly. And then you'll come back and try again.
It's my assignment to sell atomics to Ascone.
They'll get you before you've gone a parsec in space. You know that, I suppose.
I don't, said Gorov. And if I did, it wouldn't affect things.
They'll kill you the second time.
Gorov shrugged.
Panyets said quietly, If I'm going to negotiate with the Grand Master again, I want to know the whole story. So far, I've been working it too blind. As it was, the few mild remarks I did make almost threw his veneration into fits.
It's simple enough, said Gorov. The only way we can increase the security of the Foundation here in the periphery is to form a religion-controlled commercial empire. We're still too weak to be able to force political control. That's all we can do to hold the Four Kingdoms.
Panyets was nodding. This I realize, and any system that doesn't accept atomic gadgets can never be placed under our religious control and can therefore become a focal point for independence and hostility.
Yes.
All right, then, said Panyets. So much for theory. Now, what exactly prevents the sale? Religion? The Grand Master implied as much.
It's a form of ancestor worship. Their traditions tell of an evil past from which they were saved by the simple and virtuous heroes of the past generations. It amounts to a distortion of the anarchic period a century ago, when the imperial troops were driven out and an independent government was set up. Advanced science and atomic power in particular became identified with the old imperial regime they remember with horror.
That so? But they have nice little ships, which spotted me very handily 2 parsecs away. That smells of atomics to me.
Gorov shrugged. Those ships are holdovers of the Empire, no doubt, probably with atomic drive. What they have, they keep. The point is that they will not innovate, and their internal economy is entirely non-atomic. That is what we must change.
How are you going to do it?
By breaking the resistance at one point. To put it simply, if I could sell a penknife with a force field blade to a nobleman, it would be to his interest to force laws that would allow him to use it. Put that baldly, it sounds silly, but it is sound psychologically. To make strategic sales at strategic points would be to create a pro-atomics faction at court.
And they send you for that purpose, while I'm only here to ransom you and leave while you keep on trying? Isn't that sort of tale backward?
In what way? Said Gorov guardedly.
Listen, Panyets was suddenly exasperated. You're a diplomat, not a trader, and calling you a trader won't make you one. This case is for one who's made a business of selling, and I'm here with a full cargo stinking into uselessness and a quota that won't ever be met, it looks like.
You mean